From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
And people are being killed down here. People were telling me their bodies were just lying out in the street. They were shooting each other. The military was shooting. One of my neighbors said the military guy shot at him. So that's what made me not want to come down here. I think we'd be safer at our own house where there are no guns.
Democracy Now! Continues its coverage of Hurricane Katrina, hearing the stories of survivors and those rescuing people from the flooded city.
We don't have any government response here. Everything that's taken place is taken place by volunteers and citizens in the area. I don't want to be critical of my government and not supportive. It's just taken so long and it's so slow. I mean, you would think in this situation, when you look around me and behind me and all this, why aren't there 50 inflatable boats in the water working a grid, making sure all these people are out of here?
Then President Bush nominates Judge John Roberts to succeed the late William Rehnquist as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
John Roberts was a protege of Chief Justice Rehnquist, and now by nominating Roberts as Chief, President Bush is signaling that he wants the court to be steered in a way that continues the work of the most influential conservative jurist of the last 100 years.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The country's focus remains fixed on the Gulf Coast and the future of the Supreme Court. In New Orleans, the city's mayor is now estimating 10,000 people may have died following last week's devastating hurricane. Meanwhile, President Bush has nominated Judge John Roberts to replace the late William Rehnquist as Chief Justice of the United States. We'll have more on the Roberts nomination in the program, but first to New Orleans. House-to-house searches are continuing in the city. Most of the dead from Hurricane Katrina have not yet been identified. And officials are warning that many may never be because their bodies decomposed in the floodwaters and heat before they were found. Dental records across the region have also been lost in the flood. In New Orleans, the water levels have begun to decrease after the Army Corps of Engineers closed a major gap in the levee that burst. Water is now being pumped back into Lake Pontchartrain, but the removal of floodwater may take months. In the words of the city's deputy police chief, New Orleans is, quote, completely destroyed. As many as 10,000 residents remain in the city either because they're still trapped or are refusing to leave. Most of the city remains without power, drinkable water, or food supply. On Monday, President Bush visited the region for the second time in 4 days. He vowed the relief effort would go on.
Listen, Laura and I have come back down to Louisiana, and then we're going over to Mississippi to let the good people of this region know there's a lot of work to be done. And we're going to continue working with the local and state people to get it done.
Meanwhile, former President Bill Clinton told CNN the government had failed the people of the Gulf Coast. He called for the eventual formation of an independent commission to examine the government's response to Katrina.
I think there should be an analysis of what happened. And I have some strong feelings about how I think FEMA ought to be organized and operated. But the time to do that, in my opinion, is after some time passes. Right now, you still have people. We're still finding bodies there. And there still may be some people alive there.
Criticism of the federal government's response is also coming from some unlikely sources, including the Pentagon. Lieutenant Commander Sean Kelly, a Pentagon spokesperson for Northern Command, revealed in the BBC that NORTHCOM was prepared to send in search and rescue helicopters from the USS Bataan almost immediately after the hurricane hit. He said, quote, "We had things ready. The only caveat is we have to wait until the president authorizes us to do so." That authorization didn't happen 4 days, even though the ship was docked just outside New Orleans. On board the ship had doctors, hospital beds, food, and the ability to make up to 100,000 gallons of water a day. The Cuban government has also announced the U.S. State Department rebuffed its offer of aid. Last Tuesday, Cuba offered to send 1,100 doctors to assist in the crisis. Cuba said the doctors could have been on the ground by last Wednesday. Meanwhile, some commentators on the web are suggesting the U.S. could learn about hurricane preparedness from Cuba. Last year, the United Nations commended Cuba as a model for hurricane preparation after surviving Category 5 hurricane. Ivan destroyed 20,000 houses, but reportedly Thankfully, no one died because the government orchestrated the evacuation of 1.5 million people to higher ground. Meanwhile, a number of musicians and actors have come to the defense of hip-hop star Kanye West. On Friday night, West appeared on the live NBC telethon and said President Bush doesn't care about black people. He also criticized the media for its portrayal of African Americans in New Orleans. Fellow hip-hop star P. Diddy told the program Access Hollywood, quote, "I think he spoke from his heart. He spoke what a lot of people feel." In New York, at least one participant in the West Indian Day Parade was seen carrying a sign that read, "Kanye West was right." While the federal government has been widely criticized for its slow response, former First Lady Barbara Bush told the radio show Marketplace that the relocation is, quote, "working very well for some of those forced out of New Orleans since they were, quote, underprivileged anyway." This is Barbara Bush speaking at the Astrodome in Houston.
What I'm hearing, which is sort of scary, is they all want to stay in Texas. Everybody is so overwhelmed by the hospitality. And so many of the people in the arenas here, you know, were underprivileged anyway. This is working very well for them.
That was Barbara Bush, mother of the president, former first lady. But survivors in the Astrodome had a different story to tell. This is Bertha Miller speaking in Houston about her missing family members.
I have no idea where they are. I am here in this city all by myself. There is no one. I'm seeing people joining with their family, and it hurts. I don't know how long I can keep my sanity. I'm afraid for my own life. If I'm missing, there is no one to say that I'm missing. So it does hurt, but I've tried to hold on.
That was hurricane survivor Bertha Miller. And there were heroic stories coming out of New Orleans. The Los Angeles Times reports a 6-year-old boy named Dumont Love helped rescue 6 young children, including a 5-month-old. Dumont was also with 3 2-year-olds, a 3-year-old, and a 14-month-old. Congressmember John Lewis is calling on the Bush administration to launch a massive Marshall-type plan to rebuild New Orleans and urban America as a whole. He said, quote, "By next year, we'll have $400 billion to $500 billion in Afghanistan and Iraq. That money could be used to help rebuild the lives of people. If we fail to act as a nation, I don't think history will be kind to us." This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to the center of the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, Democracy Now! Producer John Hamilton spent the last several days in Louisiana. He filed this report.
It's Saturday afternoon in Orleans Parish, 6 days after Hurricane Katrina hit. It's here that the waters of Lake Pontchartrain have flooded the Crescent City. What were once the streets of New Orleans are now a series of canals marked only by street signs scarcely breaking the surface of the water. I've come on a small motorboat with Dr. Tootie Shivan and Floyd Simeon. At the helm are 2 volunteers who rode in from Louisville, Kentucky. We've come to look for survivors.
My name's Lenny Cameron. That's my partner back there, Chad Jones. We came down on Wednesday, got here in New Orleans. We brought down a boat and went out. Got a couple people on the other side of town. Okay. Got a couple people on the other side of town. Then we hooked up with Floyd and Tootie here. They're from New Orleans. And got this boat running, went out again yesterday. There's still a lot of people out here on the roofs. We got about probably 10 people out yesterday. Got a few of them to the hospital. But this is going on day 6, Saturday, here in New Orleans. And there's still, it's a disaster. There's still a lot of people on the rooftops from what we hear, running out of food and water. So we're just trying to get out here and do what we can do. Edgar here, we just hooked up with him at the boat ramp, and we're trying to find his family. They've been in here since Monday. He talked to them yesterday. They're on the rooftop, and they're running out of food and water as we speak right now. So we're trying to hook up with them and see if we can get them out of here. People out here dying, basically.
Scattered throughout the canals are bands of citizen volunteers in small motorboats. While helicopters buzz high overhead, there's not a single government vessel to be seen. What? Scouting for survivors at the front of the boat is Dr. Tootie Shivan.
I live in New Orleans. We live in this parish. This is our neighborhood, Jefferson Parish. And we left for the hurricane and came back Monday night hoping that we could help some people because, I don't know, looking at the response to this storm, particularly initially, there wasn't a lot of outside help, so we decided that really it was up to the people of Jefferson Parish to take the parish back and help. And that's basically what Aaron Broussard has been saying on the radio, you know, that we're going to all come together and rebuild, and it's really going to be up to the people that are from here. So we came down to our neighborhood to see what we could do. We brought some food in from FEMA to the East Jefferson Hospital. I did volunteer some of my medical services on the other side of the lake at Covington Hospital, but it seemed like they had enough physicians over here. East Jefferson Hospital is the only hospital that's up and running right now. So yesterday we came in with a convoy and we brought some food and water just on our vehicle. And we came down here to see what we thought was going to be the lakefront, and it was our neighborhood underwater. So we commandeered a boat and we went out. And that's when we met Lenny and Chad, who came in from Louisville just to help people. And they had been out yesterday and said that they had heard some people screaming from their rooftops out here. So yesterday we came out in this boat, and we didn't find anybody. But we're hoping that today it will be different. We have Edgar with us, who knows where some people are. So we're hoping that we're going to be able to find them. I was in a hospital in Covington on Tuesday where I was the only physician. Wasn't any flushing toilet facility. It was really, really bad news. Patients just kept coming and coming and coming. This East Jefferson is up and running like normal. The doctors are there. The nurses are there. I think they have limited supplies, but they do have supplies. They have fresh food and fresh water. And it looks like they're very well guarded by the National Guard.
Tell me more about the Covington Hospital. Talk about that.
Well, we came into Mandeville initially. And at first, we went to Lakeview Hospital, and I presented myself to the emergency room staff and said I was a physician and I was there to help. They said they were fine and they didn't need any help. So we left from there and we went to Covington to the Emergency Operations Center to ask where we could be of any value, because Floyd has a lot of survival skills and he's trained the Marines before in survival techniques at the Marine Survival Training Institute. And so we presented ourselves and our skills to the Emergency Operations Center in Covington. And they sent us over to the Covington High School, where they had set up what they thought was going to be a special needs hospital. So the intended thing for this hospital was to have people in hospital beds at home, brought by their family members with their caregivers. However, as the night wore on, obviously, people came in, floating in from the water in Slidell and various other places. So it turned into a slightly more acute care facility than it had begun. When I got there, there was one physician that had been there from Saturday until Tuesday. Asked him if he wanted some rest, and he walked right out the door. So for the next little while, it was just me and Floyd. We had absolutely no supplies, so I sent Floyd out pirating supplies. He went to all the different hospitals and emergency rooms and collected what he could and brought it back to me. And we did very well, I think. We had over 200 patients there. We had only two die in the whole day.
When you said pirating supplies, what did you mean exactly?
I mean, he went and begged. He went and begged. But we always call him the pirate, because he's got a big black truck and he carries a parrot and all that. So he was out asking for help from the other hospitals. And they were giving up everything that they could, but nobody wanted to give up anything at that particular point in time, because we had no idea when any supplies were coming. At that point in time, it was the day after the storm, and we didn't see any outside help coming in. And we didn't know when it was coming or why it wasn't coming. And we had no communication on the North Shore. We had no telephones, no radio frequencies, no cell phones. So even 5 miles away, we didn't know what was happening. We kept hearing things were very bad in Slidell, and we didn't know how bad they were until I got some patients that had been swimming in this exact water in Slidell. And then we found out how bad it was.
How bad is the water here? Is it a serious health hazard?
I think it is. From my medical opinion, yes. I mean, we have corpses here. We have corpses that have been here for a few days. We have animal corpses. We have human corpses. We have sewage. It's just sitting here. This is a different climate than what people know. It's been over 100 degrees here every single day with this stagnant water. There are some fish in it, but it's some dirty water. I think it's going to be a serious health risk, particularly West Nile. We have West Nile already in Louisiana before this happened. We haven't had a whole lot of deaths, but we have had incidents of West Nile killing people, and I think that this still water is where those mosquitoes breed. And now we've got all these mosquitoes and all these people and all this dirty water, and I think it's just pestilence waiting to happen. I'm very concerned about this water and these conditions for the people that we do save.
With thousands of New Orleans residents dying of exposure, dehydration, illness, and even starvation, New Orleans survivors fear yet another danger, Reports of free-roaming gangs and vigilante violence have circulated widely on the radio and by word of mouth. Lenny Cambron has come armed, a 9mm pistol in his pocket. In the distance is a railroad tie which spans across the flooded street, forming a small island and severing the canal. Lenny peers through binoculars at a pair of figures standing on the track.
They got guns.
What?
Oh, they're sheriffs. They're sheriffs.
You sure?
I don't know. Yeah, wait, let me check. Yeah, he's a sheriff.
We meet New Orleans volunteer firefighters who've commandeered a boat on the far side of the barrier formed by the railroad tracks. Across the tracks, volunteer firefighters have brought in three hurricane survivors. A stepladder and life vests serve as a makeshift backboard for the most severely injured of the bunch, who survived 6 days in his home despite a crippling back injury.
I'm wearing shot, and they carried me on a ladder with a board on it to keep my back from being wrenched.
You'll see, it's going to come up to land.
And we're going to get out of here, and I don't know where I'm going.
Let's go.
And it's going to be fun, I guess.
Warren is loaded onto our boat along with survivors Krista Clark and Joseph Broussard, Floyd and Tootie press east to search for survivors. Across the tracks, Chad Jones hotwires the ignition and we're off.
Yeah, we're just trying to get these people to this makeshift medical center up here. Hopefully there's a doctor that can take these people somewhere. He's got a bad back. We want to take him and get some help.
In the back of the boat, shell-shocked survivors Krista Clark and Joseph Broussard reflected on their six-day ordeal, trapped in the flood zone.
It happened just like that. All of a sudden, it's Hurricane 5. And that's when I started freaking out, because I've never been through anything like this before. I'm from California. I'm used to earthquakes. Those didn't scare us. But this is definite big-ass catastrophe.
One for them and these rescue people, you know, like I said, I wouldn't know what to do because I never experienced this and it's freaking me out, you know. So thank God for them, you know, and that's about it.
Do you have any family here?
No, sir. I have a stepbrother and stuff like that, but they're probably gone already, you know. And the phones are out, so we ain't had no way to contact them.
Okay, gotcha.
We reach a highway overpass stretching above the floodwaters. Krista, Warren, and Joseph are unloaded by a ragtag group of EMTs, firefighters, and Border Patrol agents. We watch as another boat of citizen volunteers unloads survivors. As we head back to the train track, Lenny Cambron worries that the police are hindering the rescue effort.
Actually, there was a couple police that told some volunteers on the other side of the city they needed to quit doing it, get out of the area, or they'd be arrested.
Back at the track, Floyd and Tootie meet us from the other side of the flood zone. They have found Edgar's parents, rattled, but mostly unharmed. Edgar is overjoyed to see them.
Thank God, yes, and the New Orleans Fire Department, thank God, too, I found them.
After ferrying Edgar's family to medical authorities, we see our first sign of boats operated by a U.S. government agency. A pair of airboats operated by the U.S. Border Patrol have joined the rescue effort. Lenny and Chad have heard there are yet more residents trapped on the other side of the railroad line, and the Border Patrol decides to follow. Once again at the railroad track, more evacuees have arrived. Angry over the pace of the rescue effort, Floyd Simeon advises Border Patrol officers on how to better coordinate their search.
There needs to be an organized search pattern. They need to work a grid, because without that, it's just bullshit. Chaos. People just wandered. I mean, even the search team is just going up and down streets looking around.
There has been search team in there?
Yeah, this is fire department we're working with here. We're waiting on them to come out. But, I mean, the whole problem is there's no grid set up. So everybody's just, you don't know if this house has been checked yet.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't know if these people are still in there or not. You don't know what's going on.
Yeah,
there are people in there who are confused as to the situation. They're actually approached two people a minute ago and asked them if they were ready to leave yet, and they said, no, we're waiting for the water to go down. And when you asked them how long you thought it would be before the water went down, he thought maybe a couple days, a week. We explained to them a month, 2 months, and it just, they don't seem to grasp the idea, and some of them are very reluctant to leave.
Floyd, what do you think about the government's response to this crisis?
What government? We don't have any government response here. Everything that's taking place is taking place by volunteers and citizens in the area. You know, I don't want to be critical of my government and not supportive. It's just taken so long and it's so slow. I mean, you would think in this situation, when you look around me and behind me at all this, why aren't there 50 inflatable boats in the water working a grid, making sure all these people are out of here? Why is it just volunteers? That's the only people you see around. And on top of that, they're trying to stop volunteers from coming in. It seems like everyone is taking this approach that this has to be handled by the professionals, and there's no professionals handling it. And then when you look at it, and they keep saying people need to stay out, you can't come home. They're telling people in St. Tammany that. They're telling people in Slidell that. They're telling people in Jefferson Parish that. And what really needs to happen is everybody needs to come home and help, because that's the only way this is going to get fixed. Everybody has to come back and fix their city. Obviously, this area is not ready for people to come back into, but there's places where we can come in. You clear the trees, you clear your roads, let them hook up the utilities, and let's get things going again. Because it's not just going to happen by everybody sitting and waiting. And that's why we're here, because we got tired of waiting. Take care, guys. See you tomorrow. Yep, let's go.
The setting sun means curfew will soon go into effect, and with it the martial law that now grips New Orleans. We get word there are as many as 40 survivors left in a single neighborhood, but they'll have to wait one more day, many without food or water, as the disaster that grips New Orleans enters its seventh day. For Democracy Now!, I'm John Hamilton in Orleans Parish, Louisiana.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
What has happened down here? Is the wind have changed? Clouds roll in from the north and it start to rain. Rained real hard and it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. River rose all day, the river rose all night. Some people got lost in the flood. Some people got away all right. River had busted through, clear down the Plaquemine. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. Louisiana. That tried to wash us away. That tried to wash us away. Louisiana. Louisiana. That tried to wash us away. That tried to wash us away. President Coolidge come down in a railroad train. That man with a notepad in his hand. President say, little fat man, isn't it a shame what the river has done to this poor cracker's lane. Louisiana. Louisiana. They're trying to wash us.
Louisiana, 1927, Randy Newman, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. In the next segment of the broadcast, we'll hear more voices of the hurricane. With the eyes of the nation firmly focused on the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, there have been major developments in the battle over the future of the Supreme Court. On Saturday, the ailing Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, passed away. He'll be buried on Wednesday. His death leaves a powerful vacancy at the helm of one of the three branches of government. President Bush moved quickly in naming his desired replacement for for Rehnquist, Judge John Roberts, the man Bush had already selected to fill Sandra Day O'Connor's seat. The 50-year-old Roberts had been set to face senators this week in what was expected to be a highly confrontational confirmation hearing. Senators have just postponed that process until next Monday. The Supreme Court now has two vacancies, giving President Bush major power to shape its political composition for the decades to come. We're joined now from a studio at Yale University, Bruce Shapiro, contributing editor for The Nation magazine, national correspondent for Salaam.com. And in New York, we're joined by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bruce, let's begin with you. Can you talk about the significance of the death of Judge Rehnquist, his legacy, and then we'll talk about Judge Roberts?
Well, I think it's safe to say that no one, not even Ronald Reagan, had the kind of influence over the Constitution, certainly no conservative had the kind of influence over the Constitution that William Rehnquist has had. His career, which begins as a young law clerk opposing Brown versus Board of Education when he's a clerk to Judge Robert Jackson, and extends all the way up through, you know, Bush v. Gore and all the way up through the last few years, his career really embodies the sort of abiding concerns of the right, the concerns with the demand to roll back civil rights, the insistence on freeing the market of New Deal regulation and social legislation, the concern for reducing the role of the federal judiciary and advancing states' rights. All of those are at the heart of the Rehnquist mission. Criminal law, the death penalty. Rehnquist was at the middle both as a lawyer in his early years, opposing participation of African Americans in Arizona, later as Assistant Attorney General in the Nixon administration, promoting political surveillance, wiretapping, and then finally as a justice, where he was the key voice, the pivotal voice in turning back civil rights and civil liberties in the last 25 years. It's a remarkable career. It's a important legacy for the right, and one I think that President Bush hopes to continue with the nomination of Judge Roberts.
Bruce Shapiro, we've been focusing a lot, of course, as the whole world has, certainly this country has, on New Orleans. What about a case from there, Plessy versus Ferguson?
This is an important part of New Orleans history, which collides with the biography of Chief Justice Rehnquist. In 1892, a group of African American community leaders and Creole community leaders in New Orleans decided to challenge the new Jim Crow laws, the segregation laws. A man named Homer Plessy tried to buy a ticket as a test case on the Louisiana Railroad out of New Orleans. He was told he had to sit in the blacks-only car. He wouldn't. He was arrested. And out of that came the great test case, which the Supreme Court at that time used to validate segregation, one of the great black marks, really, in American history, the moment that separate but equal became the law of New Orleans, the law of Louisiana, the law of the land. Well, you fast forward some six decades. This young law clerk, William Rehnquist, is sitting in the chambers of Judge Jackson, whom he's clerking for. Brown versus Board of Education is being argued out before the court in its early phases. This is 1952. And young William Rehnquist takes it upon himself to write a memo, a now notorious memo, arguing to Judge Jackson that Plessy versus Ferguson, the doctrine of separate but equal, was correctly decided and should be upheld, that Brown versus Board of Education and desegregation should be turned back. Well, many years later, Judge Rehnquist claimed he wrote that memo only at the request of Judge Jackson. Most of Jackson's biographers and historians dispute that. They point out that Jackson voted in favor of Brown, that he favored desegregation of the schools. And there's no doubt that throughout his career, Chief Justice Rehnquist had an abiding concern with turning the court away from defending minority rights and from turning the court away from enforcing the legacy of Brown versus Board of Education. I think you can see playing out in the streets of New Orleans today, in the Astrodome in Houston, in the faces of refugees, the legacy of separate but equal, the legacy of Plessy versus Ferguson, and I think it's really a black mark against Judge Rehnquist's jurisprudence that he was never one to consider the social consequences of the conservative legal theories that he championed.
Bruce Shapiro, what about his practice before he was not only the justice, the Supreme Court Chief Justice and judge on the Supreme Court, but his time in Arizona, his history?
Well, you know, in the 1950s and early 1960s, William Rehnquist became a sort of Republican activist lawyer in Arizona, where he had settled. And in that guise, he both opposed the desegregation of restaurants, lobbied against public accommodation ordinances, and perhaps most critically, he worked as a volunteer Republican challenging African-American voters at the polls, trying to get them stricken from voting on the day of the election. This was brought up, revealed in his 1986 confirmation hearing as Chief Justice. It wasn't enough to derail him, and yet it reflects again and shows the continuity in his career. This was not someone who had some revelatory moment when he turned his back on the legacy of Plessy versus Ferguson, the legacy of separate but equal. This is someone who throughout his career worked hard to limit Brown versus Board of Education, to limit civil rights laws, to pull the country as far back toward the days of no federal role in advancing civil rights as he could.
Bruce Shapiro, what about his young law clerk, John Roberts, now been nominated by President Bush not only to be a member of the Supreme Court with hearings, well, they were actually set for today, but now with the death of William Rehnquist to replace him as the youngest Supreme Court Chief Justice in, what, something like 200 years?
I think it's important to understand that Judge Roberts, while unquestionably brilliant and described by his friends as gracious and genial, politically, ideologically, legally, is a true acolyte of Chief Justice Rehnquist. And I mean that in a few specific ways. First of all, like Chief Justice Rehnquist, he is not one who believes that the federal government has an expansive role in enforcing civil rights. In fact, as a young Justice Department official, and more recently, he's argued that Congress should be able to limit federal courts' enforcement of civil rights laws. That's crucial. He's not one to ever turn away from harsh punishment, tough law and order prescriptions. His opinions, his arguments, his writings are replete with that. And I think most critically, very much like his mentor, Judge Roberts is a big defender of expansive power by the executive branch, and particularly the president's ability to act in the war on terror as he likes. In a few weeks ago, right at the same time that he was being nominated, Judge Roberts, in an action that was very reminiscent of arguments Rehnquist had made in his youth, his younger life, arguing for Nixon's invasion of Cambodia, Judge Roberts was one of three judges to uphold the administration's military tribunals at Guantanamo, to say that the Geneva Conventions had no application, to place this idea of presidential power outside the reach of Congress, beyond the reach of courts. That is Judge Roberts, and in that sense, he really is a true acolyte of Chief Justice Rehnquist, who, like Chief Justice Rehnquist, has never looked back or wavered from his early commitments.
We're talking to Bruce Shapiro. He teaches journalism at Yale University, writes for The Nation and Salon.com. We're also joined by the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner, as Bruce raises the issue of Guantanamo. Can you talk specifically about this case that Judge Roberts ruled on and the kind of action you're taking right now?
Well, the case that Bruce is referring to is Hamden v. Rumsfeld. It was a challenge to the military commissions that are about to be used at Guantanamo. The central issue in the case that Bruce mentioned is the application of the Geneva Conventions. And the first part is whether a person can even raise that issue. And the second is whether any person at Guantanamo, the people in those, in that case, Mr. Hamden or any of our clients at the center, are protected by fundamental protections of the Geneva Conventions. And there are two, really, the right to a fair trial and the right to humane treatment and to be free from torture. That's what was at issue in that case. The case came down, as Bruce mentioned, 3-0 on part of the issue, having to do with the right to raise the Geneva Conventions issue. But on a key part of the case, whether there were rights under the Geneva Convention, under what we lawyers call Common Article 3, it was a 2-1 decision with Roberts in the two, and there being a concurrence by Williams saying that he believed that the Geneva Convention did provide certain fundamental rights to Guantanamo detainees. Now, what's remarkable to me, that case came down on July 19th. The case came down on July 15th. It was argued on April 7th. On April 1st, Judge Roberts met with Alberto Gonzalez to discuss the question of his being nominated as a Supreme Court justice. So a week before the case is argued, he's meeting with Alberto Gonzalez. And over the course of that litigation, before it's decided, he's met with really everybody in the Oval Office and the White House. He's met with the president. He's met with the vice president. He's met with various aides of the counsel, et cetera, while the case is pending. Now, it seems obvious that here he is, and the counsel in the case didn't know anything about those meetings. He's sitting on a case that's central to this administration's claims for power in the so-called War on Terror, which is the application of the Geneva Conventions. He's meeting with Alberto Gonzalez, the very guy who actually is the architect of part of the policies on the Geneva Conventions, and yet he says nothing to the lawyers for the Guantanamo detainees, nor does he actually recuse himself from the case because of the obvious appearance of impartiality. That's where it stands, and then we have taken some action since then.
Looking at the meeting, the Hamden case argued on behalf of the administration by a top Gonzalez deputy, Assistant Attorney General Peter Kiesler. And then talking specifically about the people he met with, you mentioned staff, Michael Ratner, Vice President Dick Cheney, the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Scooter Libby, the White House Chief of Staff, Andrew Card, Bush's top political strategist, Karl Rove, and the White House legal counsel, Harriet Myers. And on the day the ruling issued was issued in favor of the administration, Bush himself conducted the final job interview with John Roberts. So specifically, what have you done?
Well, specifically, what we did last week is we filed a motion to recuse Judge Roberts from that decision, retroactively, to say he should not have taken any part in that decision, and we did it on behalf of one of our Guantanamo detainees, along with another private law firm that's representing them, with the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we did that saying, this decision not only affects Mr. Hamden, but it affects all of our Guantanamo detainees, because this is the circuit saying that two of the judges saying there are no rights under the Geneva Convention, central to the issues of all the Guantanamo detainees. And at the time this judge made that decision, when Judge Roberts made that decision, he should have recused himself according to U.S. law, a statute that says appearance of impartiality requires recusal or removal from the case. And so we're asking now that essentially that decision be vacated, or his part of that decision be treated as a nullity. We're arguing the continuation of the Guantanamo case is this Thursday in the same court, and the question is the court going to feel it's bound by what Judge Roberts said in that decision? It's incredible to me. What's amazing to me, Amy, is that this hasn't been a huge stink. We have some people on the Judiciary Committee, Senator Schumer, Senator Feingold, and hopefully, and I think Senator Leahy, saying this is a serious issue. The media hasn't picked it up. This is amazing. This is a guy getting a job offer. The highest job a lawyer can attain, really, in the United States, a job offer while the central case to the administration is pending. And nothing is being said about it. Nothing was done about it. And so we filed these court papers saying, knock this guy off this case.
And then it would be 1-1 in
the case. Either they would re-argue the whole case, or they would assign another judge, or it would be one-to-one and would have no precedential value on the issue we are really concerned about, the application of Geneva to the Guantanamo detainees.
Bruce Shapiro, your comment on that, and then I want to quickly ask you about Roe versus Wade and reproductive rights under, if Roberts were to be confirmed as Chief Justice, a Roberts court.
There's no doubt that the Hamden case represents a massive, massive blind spot and should be an ethics scandal for someone about to be appointed Chief Justice of the United States. What's crucial in what Michael is saying here to understand is that while, yes, judges who are getting promoted have to meet with the Justice Department all the time, even though the Justice Department is bringing cases before them, what makes this different is the stakes on both sides. On the administration side, this was a case central, is a case central to the entire legal strategy for the war on terror, as far as the Bush administration is concerned. And on Roberts' side, the stakes are just as high. This is for a lifetime appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. At that time, we didn't know it was going to be Chief Justice. And you have to ask, a reasonable person has to ask, does anyone think that President Bush would have been standing in the Rose Garden introducing Judge Roberts if his opinion had come down the other way after all of these secret meetings which were not revealed to the lawyers for Hamden? This is, in fact, an ethics scandal, and I suspect it will make at least some waves in the hearings next week, especially given the new job that Roberts has been proposed for.
Bruce Shapiro, Roe v. Wade, reproductive rights.
Well, you know, Chief Justice Rehnquist was one of, at that time, two justices to vote against Roe when it came before the Supreme Court. He voted again against the reaffirmation of Roe in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992. We don't know for sure where Judge Roberts falls on the Roe versus Wade spectrum. We do know that he's not a judge who has ever had a kind word to say about privacy rights or addressed the existence of the privacy rights, sexual privacy, which lies behind Roe versus Wade. My guess is that, like Chief Justice Rehnquist, he's a bit of a pragmatist on this question. He's not going to rush to throw Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, now twice affirmed, out. In his confirmation hearings as a judge, he said this was a well-established precedent. What I think we will find is a judge, a Chief Justice, very friendly to new restrictions, to making abortion harder to get, to giving states far more latitude in restricting the availability of reproductive technology and abortion rights. It's a very important question.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Bruce Shapiro teaches journalism at Yale University, contributing editor for The Nation magazine, national correspondent for Salon.com, and here in our New York studio at the Firehouse, Michael Ratner, president of Center for Constitutional Rights. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, more voices from the hurricane. Stay with us.
In all the fall, now I've got to take Christmas now in my overhaul. But by and by, I'll overcome some sweet day. Going up the country, won't be back till fall. Time getting no better, won't be back at all. But by and by, I'll overcome some sweet day. You treat me like didn't know my name. You mistreat me now for another man. But by and by, I'll overcome some sweet day.
I'll overcome someday. Bye. by Mississippi Bracey. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, and low-power FM stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. We are podcasting at democracynow.org, and our headlines are in Spanish at our website. I'm Amy Goodman. 1 week after Hurricane Katrina smashed into the Gulf Coast, nearly the entire population of New Orleans has been evacuated. The streets are deserted, littered with fallen trees and twisted metal. Nearly 80% of the city remains submerged underwater, and the number of dead remains unknown. Most of the nearly 500,000 residents of New Orleans have been driven into what the New York Times calls a modern-day diaspora of biblical proportions. But before the evacuation, tens of thousands of mostly poor African-American residents endured days of appalling conditions as they waited to be rescued. Survivors told horror stories from inside the Superdome and the convention center. Others stayed at home to avoid the mayhem. Democracy Now! Producers John Hamilton and Sharif Abdelkaddous traveled to New Orleans this weekend. They went to the convention center on Sunday afternoon. The site was completely evacuated. Well, almost. Three people remained at the site from the tens of thousands that had passed through over the previous week. They sat alone among the rows of empty chairs strewn outside. One of them told her story.
I'm Olivia Johnson McQueen. We live in the Bywater section of New Orleans, which is historical landmark section. And we didn't have a whole lot of water, but the wind blew the rain. Our roof is off. There's water's all in the house from the rain. And we have no water, no gas, no lights. You know, guys come around. The military's come around and brought some food and water and stuff like that. But for the most part, it's frightening because people are setting fires here and fires there. Things are blowing up. Matter of fact, the house was shaking like an earthquake. So that's what kind of prompted us to get up and leave. It's time to go. We'll come back when you guys get everything straightened out.
And so you've been in your house for a week. This is the first time you come to the convention center?
This is the first time.
And what were you hearing about what was happening here?
Well, we've been people being killed down here. People were telling me their bodies were just lying out in the street. They were shooting each other. The military was shooting. One of my neighbors said the military guy shot at him. So that's what made me not want to come down here. I think we'd be safer at our own house where there are no guns. So that's the reason why we decided to come today, because it seemed rather calm listening to it on the radio. But other than that, we just sat in the house as best we could.
And what are your thoughts on the relief effort here? What's your judgment on it?
Well, from what I can see, it hasn't been much relief. I've seen we picked up an old lady off of steps. She told me, I think it was a helicopter, picked up her son. Her son was ill. And they left her. She was there with no food and water for 2 days, and she was sitting outside. So we walked into the nearest school, and then the school didn't want to keep her because she didn't have her medicine and all that, and we didn't know what to do. And luckily enough, an ambulance drove up. So I begged them to take her, and they took her. You know, she must have been a good 90 years old, which she could barely stand. And, well, as I can see, that's ridiculous that you have that criteria to go into a school at that age. Yeah, I don't understand that. But just the thing in general, the whole relief effort hasn't seemed to be much to me. And particularly when I see old people are walking along the streets, you know, knowing what I saw a lady today. I gave her some water. She could barely walk. She, you know, no family. She doesn't know where anybody is or where to go, what to do. We did the same thing. Walked her to the nearest school. And I just had to leave her there because I had no place to bring her any better than she had. So that's the relief efforts, man. As far as the older people are concerned, you know, we can kind of make it. But those old people are catching hell out there.
And there was a much larger force of National Guard and troops that came in the last couple of days. How has that changed your situation?
Well, it made me feel safer. Although they made him take his shirt off and all that to see if he had any weapons, and we were at home. You know, but other than that, I feel safer. You know, at least I know now. That's one of the reasons why we came, because we knew the more guards they had, the less trouble they would have. And we would be less likely to be shot for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's about it.
Was there a curfew here?
Yeah, 6 o'clock.
And what would happen if you were out after that?
They said shoot on sight. I don't know what happened because I was never out after 6 o'clock.
Olivia Johnson McQueen speaking at the New Orleans Convention Center on Sunday in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Tens of thousands of poor, overwhelmingly African-American residents suffered the most as rescue operations faltered. And as troops from the National Guard, Marines, and Coast Guard began to flood the city, many black residents pointed to what they saw as a racially skewed government policy. This is Henry Alexander speaking outside his small record store in the Algiers neighborhood of New Orleans.
Nobody here but us, and we just got to look out for one another. All your politicians, they want to get on TV, talking about feeding this person, feeding that person. We ain't seen nothing over there yet.
Apparently there's a curfew after 6. Could you talk about that?
Well, after 6, 5 o'clock, I'm running home.
Why?
You know, because I don't want to get shot by these crazy policemen. See, they're breaking and everything, but they're talking about looters. They're doing the looting themselves. You know, they're breaking and stuff themselves, taking care of their family. You know, then you know the National Guard, they treat us nice. They pass and give us water and stuff. And, you know, like I say, you know, since the National Guard, you know, I didn't want to play policeman now. You know. We take 5:30 before it get dark, I'm gone.
Have you seen any looting?
I've seen plenty of looting around here, you know. People taking care of their kids, family, you know. I mean, you stand 3 or 4 days without something, you're going to break in something. You know what I'm saying? And, I just hate people trying to take TV and things, but the police was doing everything. You know, I'm going to take care of my family, too. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to survive and stuff like that. So that's all it is, survival.
What would you like to say to people around the country?
Well, I would like to say one thing. We need help. We need help around the country. We need help because everybody playing politics now. Those that got a big position in Louisiana, they're playing politics. So we like the people from around the world to see that, you know, what type of politics we have in Louisiana, you know?
What do you think of Mayor Red Nagin?
Red Nagin? I don't know what to say about that guy, you know. You know what I'm saying? I know one thing, he ain't doing his job. You know, he wait till the last minute to do something. Don't wait till the last minute. Don't wait till the last minute to turn black. You should have stayed black from day one. That's all I'm saying about him, you know? You're going to wait till the last minute and turn black. No, you should have stayed black from day one, you know? The whole thing, look like the whole thing. You got thousands of black folk laying on the grass out there on Causeway 3 or 4 days without nothing to eat, stuff like that. So they urinating on the ground, they waste. Letting their waste, relieving their waste on the ground. You know what I'm saying? This not India or South Africa. You know what I'm saying? This America. You know, you got Bush sent billions of dollars over here, some 40 billion, whatever. But we ain't seen nothing started yet, you know? Look like nobody know how to get nothing started. Nobody know how to open it for your door. It's messed up, man. All these politicians ain't nothing. Now, see, once it's over with, I'm going to see what they're going to do. If they're going to get the black jobs and, you know, get the black contracts to the white, you understand, because they're looking out for the white, their own people.
Henry Alexander outside his record store in the Algiers neighborhood of New Orleans. On Monday, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin estimated 10,000 people may have died in a city following the devastating hurricane. Across the country, thousands of people have been desperately trying to track down loved ones using websites to do that. Last week, Democracy Now! Went to Craigslist and talked to several people who had posted names on that list who were searching for relatives and friends. We caught up with some of them again yesterday for an update on their searches.
My name is Diana Rochon. I am still looking for Barita Scott of 6349 Pauline Drive in New Orleans, Louisiana. She is a woman that will be 89 years old on September 29th. My phone number is 773-613-6608. We are frantic to hear from her. We love her, we miss her a lot, and we want to be able to take care of her. Please help us. All of the family members have been watching CNN and MSNBC and all of the TV coverages looking for her face, We have been on the internet. We have a family phone network where we have been calling each other. We have been frantic to find any information at all regarding her. My name is Judy Lenzi. I am still looking for my sister, Victoria M. Lenza. She lives one block outside the French Quarter, and we are not able to contact her by telephone. And we don't know where she is. If anyone has seen or heard from her and knows that she's safe and well, please contact me at 630-202-6970.
My name is Hilda White Singleton, and I'm on my way right now to the Astrodome in Houston, Texas. I'm still looking for one brother. His name is Anthony White. I located the rest of my family except for him. And if anybody see him or recognize the name, can you please get in contact with me as soon as possible? I appreciate it. And thanks for everything. And God bless. And I hope it works out fine for us all.
And another update. Last week, we reported that musician Alex Chilton was missing in New Orleans. He's since been located and has reportedly been evacuated from the city. We're joined now in our studio by Carl Webb, a 39-year-old war resister seeking discharge from the Texas National Guard. His whole family is from New Orleans. He hasn't been able to contact them since the hurricane hit on Monday morning. Carl, you also listed your mother, is that right, at Craigslist online?
Yes, somebody sent me an email, I think via New Orleans Indie Media, and said that if you go to Craigslist, you could possibly find a list of folks looking for her.
How have you been looking? How can you find where your family is?
Well, basically, I've been using not the government, and the Red Cross is so bureaucratic. I've been using the alternative of media. I'm an editor with Tennessee Indie Media, and I found out that New Orleans Indie Media was still up and running. So I sent them an email and told them to post a message that I was looking for my family. I've been to other Yahoo groups that individuals on their own outside of the government have been setting up. I've been trying to establish a network that way.
This weekend, listening to one of the head National Guardsmen saying this is the best reason to join the National Guard so you can help with devastating situations like these. You are a war resister. You were in the Marines, is that right?
No, I was in the Texas Army National Guard.
Texas Army National Guard. What about that? And you... What about going down to New Orleans?
Well,
and
I would tell that general he's on crack. This hurricane is just another example of how oppressive the capitalist system that we live under is. And it's an extreme example. It's just one more example of why I refuse to fight for this government, for this system. And I'm sure that there are other people in the military on bases and ships and planes around the world are wondering why, you know, they weren't sent in or allowed to come back home and help their folks. So it's not going to be a recruiting tool.
I was thinking of Celeste Zapala, who lost her son, Sherwood Baker, who joined the Pennsylvania National Guard to deal with natural disasters like this, but ultimately was sent to Iraq and died there.
Yes, and that's one of the misconceptions that people have about the National Guard. The National Guard is not an institution primarily there to assist in natural disasters like this. It's not there to protect the population. It's just to augment the regular army to go around the world and oppress people.
Well, Carl Webb, we'll continue to be in touch with you to find out if you're able to find your family.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming in. And special thanks today to Marty and Bill Martin of Baton Rouge for their hospitality to the Democracy Now! Crew while they were in Louisiana this weekend. And special thanks to Sharif Abdelkadous and John Hamilton for bringing us the reports they have from New Orleans and Baton Rouge. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich and Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper. Sharif is our engineer as well today. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.